Jackson, Duff Costello, Ramu Dallas, 2481. You remember the subject that we are discussing is the uncertainty of the Gemara about Yesh Avelut Shabbat or Ein Avelut Shabbat. Okay? And to just recall what that means, that comes the Shabbat, and we know that the Shabbat does not cancel mourning, but one is not supposed to mourn on the Sabbath. So, if the fact that the Shabbat doesn't cancel mourning is so, shows in a way the either the weakness or the strength of the Shabbat, what impact does that have in fact upon the actual expression of mourning? Now we're going to get down to some details, but that won't necessarily solve the problem, but it will at least help us to understand more the parameters of the problem. 24A1 on the right side, halfway down the page, in English. Amar Shmuel. Tachaz Chova Netar Reshut. That's a very elliptical kind of a statement. It's the result of acronyms, and the Gemara will tell us what those acronyms are, but let's just say to begin with, Techet Zayin Chova. That would mean that Techet Zayin, whatever those things refer to, are laws of Avelut. Right? They're mourning practices that pertain during the week. And then comes Chova, and the word Chova is very hard to understand, but in the context you're going to see that it means that those things it is obligatory not to do on the Sabbath. So it's a little bit of negative. Not that it's obligatory to do, but it's obligatory not to do. Those things which you are obliged to do during the week, you're obliged, Chova, it is obligatory not to do. Okay? Because you're not supposed to be mourning on the Sabbath. Okay? Netar Reshut. Nun Tav Resh. There are other things that you in fact may do on the Sabbath. You may do on the Sabbath. Okay? They're Reshut. They're optional. Now, the Gemara explains what these acronyms are all about. First one was Pechaz, Pei Chet Zayin. Pei Chet Zayin, first the Pei is Priat Arosh. Priat Arosh. Okay? Now you remember that there was a mourning practice which is no longer practiced, was not practiced already by the Middle Ages, but which we have read about as being a basic part of Talmudic practice of what was called Atifat Arosh. Atifat Arosh. The wrapping of the head. A mourner, the practice of a mourner was to wrap the head. And that obviously was some sort of a public sign of mourning. It was a public sign. There, when we did that last year, we talked about the meaning of atifa. And like lehitatef patzitzit. And even when you say the bracha lehitatef patzitzit, you're supposed to wrap the head when you put on the talit. Because atifa implies a wrapping of the head. Okay, so here, the custom then was to wrap during the week, and therefore it is chova, it is obligatory to unwrap for the Sabbath. Why? Because wrapping was very obvious. Wrapping was a public statement of your mourning. And because you walk around with this material, whatever it was, we'll see some description in a little while. But it was odd, and it identified you as a mourner. So that kind of a public statement that you are mourning is inappropriate on the Sabbath. Therefore, it is chova lifroa, to undo it, to undo it. Next one is chazarat kera la'achorav, turning the rent to the back. When you wear a garment with a rend in it, everybody looks at you and they see obviously that you're a mourner. That's called public mourning. since the public is engaged in the observance of the Sabbath, and to a greater or lesser extent you are as well, I'm not sure exactly what the parameters of that are, what the limitations are, but surely the public is engaged in that kind of an observance, and therefore you have to turn around the wren to be on the back. Assuming, of course, that you only have one piece of clothing. That's the assumption here. What it means is, in our context, you don't wear your kriya on the Sabbath. You don't wear your kriya on the Sabbath. Okay? Why? It's public. It's a public message. That's, in fact, the way it's experienced by people. People look at you. They say, oh, you're a mourner. And they want to do what's appropriate, which is to console mourners. That's not exactly right on the Sabbath. Okay, that's not the atmosphere we're seeking to develop on the Sabbath. So that's number two. Chova, it is obligatory to turn the wren around. Three, zikifat amita. You remember that one of the customs was kfiat amita. Kfiat amita was turning over the bed. Turning over the bed. Now exactly how this is public, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how that's public. But in some way, whatever this meant, and we don't really know what it means because we don't do it, and we haven't done it for probably close to 2,000 years. So it's not exactly sure, but in some way it is understood to be public, and so you have to upright the bed. Okay? So those things are chova. Those are obligatory. That's tichas. Now we go on. Now we learn what mitar is. Nilata sandal. Wearing leather shoes. Nilata sandal. And remember, mitar is reshut. Reshut means that, what did you say? No, not that it's optional is a better way to translate it here. That they're optional as opposed to obligatory. Okay? So nilata sandal is optional. Now that appears to say then that if you want to wear shoes, you can wear shoes. The mourner is not supposed to wear shoes. The mourner is not supposed to wear shoes. Of course, keep in mind here that what could be the public side of this? Well, it could be, there are two different ways to look at this. One, when you leave the house as a mourner, if you were to wear odd-looking shoes, that's again a sign that you're mourning. Okay? I mean, when, for example, on Yom Kippur, you see people on Park Avenue dressed in beautiful suits, wearing sneakers, it's very weird. But the community has some sense that there is an appropriateness to it. Okay? For many people in the community, they can't get themselves to do it because it's just too weird. It's too weird. But you'll see, you walk in this neighborhood on Yom Kippur, and that's what you see. You even see it on Tisha B'Av. On Tisha B'Av, where people will dress like that. People tend not to be dressed as fancily on Tisha B'Av as they are on Yom Kippur for good reason. It's also the summertime. But footwear speaks. Certain types of footwear is just odd. And here, wearing leather shoes, or when you're a mourner, you can't wear the leather shoes. And therefore, wearing shoes, nilata sandal, would be indicative of the fact, well, not wearing shoes would be indicative of the fact that you are mourning. So here we say, if you want to wear them, you can. If you don't want to wear them, you don't have to wear them. Because the other side of this is that a lot of, it could be that the mourner is going to spend most or all of that time in the house. And the truth is then, as now, people don't always wear shoes at home. People sometimes take their shoes off and they wear other types of foot gear in the house, which they wouldn't be wearing outside, namely slippers, or things like slippers, informal house shoes. And the reason we even have a term for that, house shoes, I think. Some people have house shoes. So that's not such a clear one, and therefore it's a shoot. If you want to do it, you can. If you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. Next one is tashmish amita. that's an interesting one, because that was basic to what we've been discussing until now about whether yesh avelut b'shabbat or ein avelut b'shabbat. That's mishamita, sexual relations. So sexual relations is surely something that's private. There's no way that you're demonstrating that on the outside, assumedly. And we see that here, that's reshut. If you want, you can engage in them. If you don't want to, you don't have to. Or if you feel that it's inappropriate because of mourning, then that's okay too. Okay? Mm-hmm. Yes?
Why they are using the Tashmish HaMitah, the Tifat HaMitah, which is the same issue, in both...
Well, we learned from the commentators that it was. But remember, the commentators were writing that 1,000 years after these people wrote it. So I'm not exactly sure. I said to you, I'm not even sure what Ziki Fata Mita means. Uh-huh. I'm not really sure whether it's referring to a bed. Commentators later understand it to be that, but that's when it was no longer done. I sometimes think that the Mita, maybe it was a couch, but that even doesn't even explain this, because I want to know what's so public about it. So I honestly don't understand it. I don't know why it's so public.
Well, maybe like in the Talmudic village, their rooms, or like they lived in one or two rooms, but maybe they
could be.
They slept in their living room.
Note on the Ritva
2482. What is the Ritva saying? 24.
Left hand column. Right
after the
fourth line. Visible to those who happen to be in the house.
Yeah, well, I can't believe that. I mean, it's possible. Yes, it's possible in a warm climate that people did sleep like that. But from everything we know, it's not the case. We know, as you were referring before to the way they lived in the time of the Talmud. We know how they lived in the time of the Talmud. Today we know that because we have archaeology. And we pretty well have reconstructed the Talmudic house and so on, then in the public, as far as I remember. So I mean, the Ritva is interesting. He's got the same problem I have. But he came up with a solution. I can't figure it out.
Is it related to the idea of marital relations during Avelut? I mean, you write your bed and you have the reshut to have relations with your wife or marital relations.
Well, that's a good point. It could be that if you write the bed, that's like broadcasting that you're going to have marital relations. That's like saying to anybody who comes into the house, oh, you know, things are normal. And whether you have them or not, you don't broadcast. And that's the Tashmish HaMitah. So that's a good possibility.
Yeah, it's like putting on leather shoes. It's just symbolic. It says to people
correct.
Who come to you.
Correct.
So, like,
so maybe that's the way to understand it, that it's vis-a-vis what goes on. These two of these things are things that go on in the house. They go on in the house, and it's for people who are visiting you, who may just, we try to minimize the sense of the public statement that you're mourning, without saying too much about the private side. That's a good possibility. Okay? I'm just more satisfied now. Thank you. Okay? That's a good possibility. So we said, so Nilata Sandal, Tashmish Amita, Rechitzat Yadayim V'Raglayim B'Chamin Aravit. And the washing of hands and feet with warm water in the evening. Now, of course, those of you who were with us 2 years ago, well, let me just finish this as we shoot. Just to recall what that's all about, remember you're not allowed to warm water and use that water that was warmed on the Sabbath to wash even the hands and the feet. Right? And then we had the question about whether you could use warm water at all. And remember we dealt with the bathhouse injunction, right? Right? So this must actually, this brighter that we're reading must predate the bathhouse injunction, because the bathhouse injunction finally forbids warm water, if you remember that. And this is permitting warm water. But remember, it seemed like there was no reason not to permit it, except for what was going on in the bathhouses, and therefore they finally prohibited it. Right? Not because of anything inherent in it, but because of an abuse that was done in public. So anyway, the mourner would have reason to especially want to wash at the Sabbath, at least in some minimal way, because the mourner is not allowed to wash. And therefore, this is here in the context considered to be a private thing that in effect is for the, if not the pleasure, at least the lack of discomfort on the part of the mourner. Okay? And that's again Rishut. Rav Amar Af Priyanta Rosh Rishut. Now, Rav adds, even the undoing of the wrapping of the head, that's Rishut. We had just read a moment ago, who was it, Shmuel, I think? It was Shmuel who said, right, Shmuel said that it's Chovah, the wrapping of the head. To unwrap the head is Chovah. Okay? Now, the reason why Rav would say that it's Rishut is the same reason that you have for Nilat HaSandal. Some people just naturally at home go around without shoes. So you don't necessarily know whether people are going around without shoes because they're mourning or because that's the way they act at home. Okay? Similarly, one might argue, it's true as far as the uncovering of the head. It could be that mourners in general, just when they were home, would uncover the wrapping. Just because that was home type behavior, and it was the kind of thing that when you went out in public, you would be sure to wear your mourning signs in public. So there's a difference between Rav and Shmuel here. Any questions so far? No, yes.
I was just wondering whether the comfort is as important as the public or another factor. Because several of these are also things that are included for lack of comfort. I know people were, you know, the warm water and the shoes and things. So maybe, you know, they're suspended from the discomfort on Shabbat, so you can write the bed, even sleep normally.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with the warm water and the same thing with the shoes, because I think that there's an element of comfort with all of those things.
Mm-hmm. It's possible. It's possible. The In the Talmud, in Masachat Ta'anit, the distinction is made, and I think it's an important distinction, where the Talmud is discussing fasting, and these are fasts, for the most part, that are fasts that are legislated by the court for lack of rain. If there is no rain, the court can declare a public fast. Wait to see then whether it's effective, and then if there's still no rain, the court can declare another public fast. There are these series of fasts. And there are a variety of customs. When it gets very serious, the customs are not very different from the Yom Kippur customs. They're really largely the same customs. And the Gemara goes in to discuss the distinction, why you have these customs. The same customs can be for two different reasons. And it's relevant to what you're saying, Bobby. One is called Sa'ar, and one is called Avelut. Sa'ar and Avelut. And the Gemara argues that on Yom Kippur, you have these customs for the purpose of Sa'ar. That is to say, it's a form of self-infliction, self-affliction. Sa'ar. Sadi Ayin Resh. Sadi Sa'ar. Right. Okay? It's a form of affliction. And that's what it is, because on Yom Kippur it's Inui Nefesh. And it argues then that it's different on Tisha B'Av. That the same customs which apply on Tisha B'Av, they're the same customs but for a different purpose. There the purpose is Avelut. Avelut. So I found that distinction to be interesting because we combine the two of them, and we assume that Tsar and Avilut are probably the same, or that one flows into the other, and that it's hard to create a distinction between them. But the Gemara itself sees a distinction between these two, so that here, if there is a distinction here, here it's clearly avelut. Okay? And it's not necessarily, I don't know whether one can talk about it as discomfort. I'm just not sure, because discomfort, in a way, is tsa'ar. Right? Avelut would be something, in a way, more psychological. You know, it would be the feeling of wanting to abandon oneself, or the lack of desire to have
pleasure.
Well, maybe. But I was thinking of relations to people. Sort of just blocking people out, blocking the world out, blocking the self out. Somehow to me it has a much more psychological dimension to it, and I can't fully articulate what that dimension is. Okay? I'm not sure. The bottom line is I'm not sure. But I think that the distinction is interesting. Now, what I think you should keep in mind here is that according to Shmuel, first of all, I think that his conclusion is not necessarily intuitively obvious, and secondly, it's not at all what I would have expected. Because we're trying to figure out whether yesh avelut v'shabbat or ein avelut v'shabbat, okay? Whether there is or there isn't avelut v'shabbat. The key practice that we had learned is the key to all of this is tashmish hamita, sexual relations, okay? And that would seem to me to be very good, because if you could say that there would that there would be sexual relations, then that means that ein avelut v'shabbat. And if there can't be sexual relations, then yesh avelut v'shabbat. That was good, but that whole way of thinking was either there is or there isn't, and sexual relations are the key to whether there is or there isn't. And what does Shmuel come and do? Shmuel comes and he says, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. So in a way, this is a disaster. I was waiting for the clarification. And then he comes and he says, of all things, reshut, that's exactly what I don't want him to say. Either he says yes or either he says no. But if he says reshut, he's saying maybe yes, maybe no.
I read it a different way.
Yeah.
Discretionary, then, you know, there's a Shabbat, because the person is permitted to have sexual relations on Shabbat.
Maybe. Maybe. You're much more moderate than I am. That's good. It could be. I wanted a much clearer clarification. All right? That's what I want. Okay. So, with that in mind, let's keep going. Now, for the next while, we're going to be basically dealing with the ramifications of Rav and Shmuel, what they mean, and then the latter part here, well, Rav and Shmuel, because remember Rav says, Af priyat arosh b'shabbat, uncovering the head on the Sabbath, is also optional rather than required. Okay, then the Gemara, we'll go back to Shmuel. Ooh, Shmuel. So, why doesn't Shmuel agree with Rav? Rav said, Af priyat arosh reshut. He says that too, because some people uncover their heads at home, some people don't uncover their heads. Well, that's true. Maishna ni'ilata sandal v'reshut. Why is wearing shoes different from uncovering the head in that it is optional? The lav kuli amra avidi desayne misanayu. Because not all people are used to wearing their shoes on the Sabbath. So, since there is a similarity between the shoes and the head wrapping, if Shmuel rejects Rav's view about head wrapping, then why does he maintain his view about shoes? Because shoes and head wrapping are basically the same thing. So it's either you agree with Rav and it's shoes and head wrapping, or it should be neither shoes nor head wrapping. But Shmuel says, shoes, yes, head wrapping, no. Okay? So that's what the Gemara is trying to point out. Okay? Yeah. Love, okay. Shmuel, letame. Well, Shmuel is at least consistent. He is consistent in what he does. The Amar Shmuel, kol kera she'eno bisha'at kimum eno kera. any rent in a garment that is not made at the time of intense grief is not a proper rent. The chol atifa she'ein ka'atifat yishme'elim eina atifa. Fascinating statement here, just sociologically. In any wrapping which is not like the wrapping of the Ishmaelites is no real wrapping. There's no real wrapping. In other words, the Ishmaelites, of course, are the Arabs. And the Arabs in those days must have worn the kafirs. Yeah, that's a good picture. That's a good picture. Because it's... What?
I'm wondering if there are any pictures.
Well, this is a
supposed
illustration of some of the commentators, because commentators, remember, the commentators don't know what wrapping means. So some of the commentators say it means like some of the Arabs.
Like the Afghans.
Like the Afghans. What do you call that? Purda. It's like the women who are in Purda. You ever see... We don't see this much in New York. I was in London two years ago. First time I ever saw a lady in Purda. Have you seen this?
In what?
Purda. That's where they have a slit about half an inch, an inch. And other than that, you don't see anything. You don't see anything. In Brooklyn, the women are walking around Purda?
There are. I think it's Atlantic
Avenue. On Atlantic Avenue?
Yeah, I mean, you won't see it in Upper East Side.
Oh, we have a mosque here. It depends on being the mosque.
One thing, if you happen to be there, one day.
Interesting. Well, they're all over. Anyway, one possibility is that we mean that it goes up very far. Another possibility is that it's up here. Third possibility is that it's over the mouth. Right? And you have all of these among the commentators. So this picture is the mouth. You wrap it around here like this, and then it covers the mouth. Because we saw also that it was not called Atifat HaSafam, but it was called something HaSafam. HaSafam, that Safam, the upper lip, was covered. So this is a good way to do both of those things at once. You cover the upper lip, and you wrap the head at the same time. Okay? Everybody. This would be everybody. Everybody did that. Okay? So, the type of covering, and it's a full head wrapping, is referred to here as the wrapping of the Ishmaelites. I'm just saying that that's the way the Arabs did it. And Machfe Rav Nachman Agufi Didikna. Rav Nachman then demonstrates the Ishmaelite, the way the Arabs would wrap, by wrapping himself in his cloak up to the hollows of his cheeks. Well, dikna really means the beard. So I'm not really sure what that means. It probably means the way that illustration is, that it goes like this, that it crosses over. All right, here's the key thing in the English. Since this particular style of head covering is in our country is generally used only by mourners, failing to remove it on the Sabbath would constitute a conspicuous form of mourning. So Shmuel says, in other words, that this is an unusual type of wrapping, and therefore you have to make sure that you don't do it on the Sabbath, because it's so unusual that it clearly conveys the message that you're dressed in the uniform of a mourner. Okay. So there's simply a consistency in the view of Shmuel, and we can understand, therefore, why Shmuel doesn't have to accept Rav's position, and why there's a difference between the lata sandal, wearing of shoes, leather shoes, and the wrapping of the head. Okay? Now, the Gemara goes on. Here the Gemara qualifies Shmuel, sitting in the mourner, uncover his head on the Sabbath. Okay, let me just see whether I have a note here. Rabbi Yaakov, Rabbi Yochanan. Lo shanu ela she'ein lo minalin beraglav. Rabbi Yaakov says in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, they taught Lo Shanu this requirement only in the case where he does not have shoes on his feet. Right? Rav and Shmuel agree, the note, that a mourner may abstain from wearing shoes on the Sabbath. Both of them agree with that. Okay? Lo Shanu, they didn't teach, they only taught that. She'en lo min alav biraglav. Avar yesh lo min alav biraglav, min alav mochichim alav. But if he has shoes on his feet, then his shoes demonstrate about him that he's not observing mourning on the Sabbath, and he is therefore not required to uncover his head. Oh, so this follows then, because there is this relation between the two, the shoes and the uncovering of the head. Okay, to go on. Shmuel, remember, said also, Kol kera she'eno bisha'at chimum eno kera. That was what Shmuel had said. Any rent which is not made in the heat of it is not a rent. Okay? It's a little difficult to understand what they're talking about here. When is one supposed to make a rent to begin with? Primary, in the time of the Talmud, the primary rend was made either at the time of death itself or soon thereafter. Okay? If you were witness to the death, if you were present, when you are present, you rend the garment. Okay? Or soon thereafter. If more time intervenes, then that's something different. Or it could be something different. Okay? We, for example, we don't rend immediately. Our custom is to rend at a funeral. That's sort of the way we do it. Probably that's still what you would call sha'at chimum. Okay? But it could be that one does it once and that one might feel that one should do it again for a variety of reasons. It could be because this happens here. It's very interesting. I've found many times when people use these ribbons, you know what happens in the middle of the week? They lose the ribbon. And so the people say, Rabbi, do you have another ribbon? Can you give me another ribbon? And of course that's all part of this ribbon business, because you can lose a ribbon. If you're rending your jacket, it's unlikely you'll lose your jacket. Your tie, you won't lose your tie. But a ribbon falls off. It's true. Question is, can you rend again? Because you lost it. Right? It's no longer bisha'at chimum. It's not in the heat or the passion or the upset of when you originally did a rend. Remember, the psychology of the rending is that one does it, it's an external manifestation of how one feels internally. Well, 6 days go by, you lose the rent. Can you do it then? Right? Those are some of the things, some of the situations that perhaps he's dealing with here. Kol kera she'en bishan chimum eno kera. Right? That's not a valid rent. Not a valid rent. The ha amru leili Shmuel nach. Interesting. You always see in the Talmud, Rav and Shmuel are arguing with one another, their colleagues, in two different Babylonian towns. And here you see the story. They said to Shmuel that Rav had died. Rav had died. Kara ale tresar mane. Really so moving. He rent in mourning over him tresar money, 12 garments. He rent 12 garments. The implication here, since this is brought as an argument against what Shmuel is saying, Shmuel himself is doing the rending. Shmuel says you can't do it afterwards. So the implication is of the 12 garments, not that he did them all at once. Because that wouldn't be a problem. That would be bisha'at chimum. in the heat of his upset. But probably what we're talking about here is over time. As time would go on, he would rend additional garments. All right? And that seems not bishat chimum. And yet it's Shmuel himself. It's Shmuel who rends 12 garments. And it's Shmuel himself who says that you have to do it bishat chimum, only in the heat of things. So how do we figure that out? Well, the Tres Amane. Amar azal gavra dahave mistafina mine. It goes on now to describe his verbal statement, his articulation of his upset. He said, the man is gone from whom I was afraid, of whom I was afraid, who I feared. It's a great sense here of two academics, or two rabbis, who were debating with one another. And here he says, he was the man I really feared. So I feared my debating partner, because he was the one who could undermine my argument. Right? But obviously it was his great respect. He had such profound respect for the one who is called in Aramaic as Bar Pokta, the one that he argued with. Okay, that he's just so filled with grief. Amru Leila Rabbi Yochanan, now we hear another case. Rabbi Yochanan was told, Nafshei de Rabbi Chanina. Rabbi Yochanan was told that Rabbi Chanina died. Keep in mind, both Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Chanina are from the land of Israel. The two that we read just now, Rav and Shmuel, are Babylonians. So the structure of this is nice, because you see first Babylonian response, two rabbis who are debating with each other, and the depth of their relationship and the upset. And then you have two in Eretz Yisrael. That's Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Chanina. Kara alei tleisar itzale milta. He rent over him 13 robes of fine silk. Right? Amazing. Amar, and he says the same thing. Azal gavra dahava mistafina minei. The man who I feared has gone away. All right? That's the sense of his colleague. So the Gemara now has two stories of people who rend numerous garments, successively, and therefore they don't do it bishaat chimum. They're not doing it in the moment of profound mourning. And the Gemara answers what is the only reasonable answer here. Shami Rabbanan, the rabbis are different. Death of the rabbis is different. The cave on the whole shata, the midkare shmatayhu, kisha adchimum dame. Because with the rabbis, every time they remembered the subjects that they would talk about, it was like their fellows had died again. Which is true. When you remember the debates, if these are the people that you had the debates with, we see it in regular mourning too, when things happen that remind you of the person, suddenly people who were fine a moment ago, they remember the conversation they had. Rabbi Soloveitchik writes one point about after his wife died, and there were certain situations which simply he remembered what she would say. When he would remember what she would say, he would be completely demolished. Mm-hmm. He couldn't handle it. He was so upset, because it was like she just died again. That's how it is here. With the rabbis, the beauty of their relationship was in their intellectual debate. And those subjects never really go away, and therefore when they would come up again, it would be the sha'at chimum, it would be the passion, the heat of the morning would be revived again, and therefore these stories in no way really contradict what Shmuel said. They simply show us that the notion of sha'at chimum is not limited by time. Usually it is limited by time, but it's certainly not always limited by time. These experiences go on in time. Okay? Zednidne ki'ilu hu sha'at chimum. Sha'at chimum means
the
heat of the moment, meaning the heat of the time that's close to death, when one is most upset. Okay?
And the funeral.
And the funeral. Okay? Those are the... One expects that there will be a cooling off, as it were, over time. And by and large, it's true. But it just isn't that easy. It can't... It's not a straight line from by any means. Okay?
This is a case of, though, they're not related to each other, the rabbis. They're actually manning farmers for something. They're almost giving themselves the status of a...
We will see. We've already seen some of that already. Remember, we saw the Abed Din, we saw the Nasi, that there were public responses to the mourning. And one will see that also with the rabbis. There are, and we see it today too. Probably we don't see it often enough, but in Israel you see it. I've never seen it here, but I've read about it happening in Israel. Israel, when some of the major rabbinic figures die, they have these enormous funerals. And the funerals of 20, 30, 50, 100,000 people go to a funeral. And there's a public mourning, and there are people who rend their garments, things like that, because the teacher, in certain circumstances, has the place of a parent. And there is some level of comparison between the teacher and the parent. As I say, I haven't seen it here. I remember one of our, if I told you, you know the name of the person I'm going to tell you a story about, but I'm not going to tell you who it is. He's a very well-known Jew. And I remember after my Talmud teacher, and Professor Lieberman died. I'll tell you who it was. Because it's a great credit to him. And you should know that he deserves, as much as you think he's terrific, he's even better than you think. This is a story about Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel used to take Talmud with us. He was in my Talmud class. And Elie always went to Lieberman's Talmud classes because he felt that Lieberman was the greatest Talmudist in our time, and that it was a great schutz, it was a privilege to study with Lieberman, and he was only up on 22nd Street on Broadway. So it was very helpful for the students that Elie Wiesel would come to class, because many of us didn't think Lieberman was as good as Wiesel thought he was. There were actually some of the students who really would just as soon not have been in class. Used to read paper in class, read the New York Times during class. But in fact, we were never sure whether we assumed he was unaware of it. We really don't know why. Sometimes we thought it was his eyesight, because he used to spend a lot of time cleaning his glasses in class. And so then we thought, well, maybe he just couldn't see all that well. But anyway, I don't mean to include present company in those things, but I'm just saying that the word class, we had all kinds of students. And the seminary has all kinds of students. But Wiesel used to come to class. And he had tremendous respect for Professor Lieberman. And Lieberman then died. And there was a funeral here in New York. And some while later, I happened to just be talking about this with Elie. And he told me what I sort of knew but really didn't know. First of all, he was very upset. In the seminary, it wasn't a major day of mourning. that the seminary really didn't care about the greatest Thomist. That he didn't receive the respect that he deserved. And we have one in a generation. The fact that the students didn't respond as was appropriate to such a great rabbi, he thought that this was just a terrible thing, and it was a bad sign about the state of the seminary and the seminary students. Lieberman himself then went on the plane, and he accompanied Lieberman. And it was Wiesel who buried Lieberman. Elie Wiesel buried my teacher. In Israel. He was buried. I don't know where he's buried in Israel, but it was Elie Wiesel who buried him. So, as much as I always have had great admiration for Elie Wiesel, he was the only person, no person in the faculty, and one would have thought the Talmud faculty of the seminary, the colleagues would have done something, and that's what upset Wiesel so much. It turned out he was the only person, he was he who went with Lieberman.
Also married already, like this at that time, or no?
I think he was married then. I'm pretty sure he was.
Some of that comes out in this comment of, this is the person I was afraid of.
Right.
Oh, that's how we were related to Lieberman. We were really afraid of him. And fear is also awe. Go ahead, Barry.
I find the issue of there's two aspects that I find fascinating. One is this professional relationship in which it isn't one of love; it's one of
fear.
It's fear and professional ego.
Right.
Competition
is the immediate response, rather than one of my God. We've lost a great person. So I find this very telling, especially in a world of big egos and the academic world that I live in as well. The other thing is that, and I don't know the quote, but the issue of the analogy between the teacher, student, parent, child one, I understand that there is a quote somewhere about the people you can never feel jealousy for are your children and your students. And I wish I actually had the precise quote, because for teachers, I think it's a very beautiful analogy to make. And in fact, for good teachers, I think it's absolutely true.
But there's a slightly different idea here. I believe it's in Masach HaKiddushin, but I'm not sure.
But I think that relationship, at its best, is very much that way.
Mm-hmm.
Not universal, but I think that it is possible to have that kind of feeling for a student that you have for a child.
Mm-hmm. Very nice.
And did Elie Wiesel, he also lend his clothes, or?
That I can't say. I don't know. I didn't ask him. I was present at the funeral, but I didn't notice these things. I just didn't see. But there you see, Wiesel is a great man. I mean, years already. Lieberman was not an old man. He was in his 60s when he died. His wife predeceased him. That's part of what's left out in the story, so I should have said that before. His wife predeceased him. His wife was, I never really knew her. I mean, I knew her only casually. But she, too, was a great intellectual. She was the headmistress of the Shulamit school. And the reason that I know about that, to the extent that I know about it, is that she was the headmistress to Fran Klagstrom. Mm-hmm. Francine was in the Shulamit school as a child. And that's where she learned. You know, Francine's background is extraordinary. So it was Mrs. Lieberman who was the head of the school. The chief teacher in the school was the mother of the late Rabbi Dr. Gershon D. Cohn.
Oh.
So there's a lot of connections here. Mrs. Cohn was Fran's teacher, and that's why Fran was so close to Gershon Cohn during the life of Gershon Cohn, because she was close to his mother, who was her teacher. So it's really lovely stories of these amazing, wonderful people and these great scholars. And Wiesel is one of the last who's still left from that world. David Weiss Halifny is also from that world, who was here a few years ago. The Weiss was here. Lieberman is gone, of course. The Weiss is probably, Weiss and Wiesel are the last two that are still around. I would say about 75. Okay. Your guess? Mm-hmm. Seem about right?
Yeah, because when he was taken away, he was about 12. Yeah.
Which was towards the latter part of the war, if I remember. It's not the beginning.
Around 1930,
1931.
30,
31? Yeah, it's about, that's about right. That's somewhere about right. Seems right. Yeah. About 75, I would say. Okay. Okay. Now, we're going to once again challenge Shmuel. Amale Ravin Bar Adal Rava. Now, we're going later. We're two generations later by the time we're dealing with Rava. And we're still in Babylonia. Amar Talmidach Rav Amram. Your student, Rav Amram, said, Tanya, that it was taught, in a Baraita. Avel kol shiv'a koro lefanat. A mourner all 7 days, that's to say, shiva, his rend is in the front. Now, of course, what Shmuel said was, you turn it around, schovat to turn it around, obligation to turn it around. Ve'im ba lahachlif machlif v'korea. And if he wishes to change his garment, he may change and rend the new garment. Now, that's to say, lo bishat chimum, not in the moment of the heat of the moment, not in the great moment of upset. B'Shabbat kor'o le'acharav. On Shabbat, now he says, he goes on, he says, on Shabbat, his rend is turned to the back. Im ba lachlif machlif ve'eno korea. And if he wishes to change his garment, he changes and does not rend the new garment. Okay, so it says that during Shiva, if a person was a mourner during Shiva, I'm sorry, during, if you put on a new garment during Shiva, you have to rend it. That's what he's saying. It's not bishat chimum. So the Gemara answers, ki tanya hahi bichvod avi v'imo. When that was taught, that is to say that you have to do it, it was in relation to one's father and mother. Okay? What Shmuel said, basic rendering, as it says, I'm reading the English, requirement applies only at the times of intense grief, as Shmuel says. In the case of one who mourns his father or mother, there's a special provision to honor the deceased parent by rending one's change of garments throughout the week of Shiva. Right, so if you have to do it again, for the parent, it's still so real, so near, so powerful, that it's still Bishat Chimus. Okay. Otan Kraim, those rends. That's to say, the rends that are made for a father or a mother. Mitachim o en mitachim. Can you sew them up or you can't sew them up? We actually had this before about the sewing up of rends for different people.
You mean afterwards?
Afterwards, correct. Pligi ba avuad Rav Hoshaya uvar kapala. There was a disagreement between the father of Rav Hoshaya and Bar Kapara. Chad amar ein mitachim, v'chad amar mitachim. One says that you can't sew them up, and the other one says that you can sew them up. Tistayin be'avuad Rav Hoshaya, damar ein mitachim. It would make sense to conclude that the father of Rav Hoshaya is the one who said that you can't sew them up. Or Rav Hoshaya had that point of view. He went on record as saying that you can't sew those things up. And from whom did he learn this ruling? Lav me'avua. Wasn't it from his father? So the Gemara says, lo. Doesn't have to be from his father. He bar kapara, rabbi shemi'alei. He learned it from his rabbi, who was bar kapara. So you really don't know which of the rabbis held which opinion. Okay. So go on. Amar Rava. Rava says, so we were just with Rava, and we're going to stick with Rava. Rava says, again the Babylonian, Rava and Abaya. Rava says, Avel mitayel ba'unkale b'toch beito. A mourner can walk around in his unkale, in his shirt that was torn. Right, he rent the garment by tearing his shirt. So Rava says that he can do that betoch beito, in the privacy of his house, privacy of his home. And here you see, when we started out, we were saying that even the home is not so private because people will come to visit you. Here you see, by the time of the Babylonians, they're beginning to see a distinction between the private and the public. Maybe houses in Babylonia and people didn't visit as much. Babylonia was like the Upper East Side. You have to be invited. Whereas in Eretz Yisrael, it's still the case till today, you just walk in. You know, that's how it is. In Israel, you don't need an invitation. You just walk in. You just come. You show up. And everybody is always expected to show up. Whereas, say the least, that's not exactly the way we function. There's different unwritten rules. So my hunch is here that Babylonia was more like us. Eretz Yisrael was the way it still is. Okay? Something's never changed. So, Avel mitayel ba'unkel lebetoch beito. The mourner is permitted to walk around with that torn garment in the privacy of his home. Abaya ashkechel Rav Yosef. Abaya, meaning, of course, on Shabbat. This is the Shabbat issue. So Abaya found Rav Yosef. Defaris lay sudra areshe, with a kerchief spread, probably meaning wrapped, around his head. So, in other words, probably this is at home now. We're talking about at home. We read before that Shmuel said that you have to unwrap it. Right? Rav said that you can wrap it, but Shmuel said you have to unwrap it. Defaris lay sudra areshe, va'aza va'ati bevete, while walking about at home. He was walking about at home. Lav savar, amar le, Abaya said to him, Lav savar la mar, ein avelut b'shabbat. Doesn't the master hold that there is no observance of mourning on Shabbat? In other words, what we had originally learned, that Shmuel said, that you're not allowed to wrap yourself, even at home, on the Shabbat. Amar le, Rabbi Yosef replies to him, Hachi amar Rabbi Yochanan, Varim shebetzina nohek. Rabbi Yochanan said, it is things that are in private one does observe on the Shabbat. This is what I've been waiting for. This is the statement of whether Yesh Avelut B'Shabbat or Ein Avelut B'Shabbat. Finally, the Gemara itself has brought the statement and this ends up in fact being the halacha. We'll look at this in just a minute. Here, this is Rabbi Yochanan. So, obviously, this wasn't concluded until the period of the Amoraim. Rabbi Yochanan is an Amora from Eretz Yisrael. He's an Israeli Amora. And we see that this lack of clarity exists right into that period of time. But Rabbi Yochanan makes it very clear what his point of view is. And the law eventually goes according to Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan, keep in mind, was also the author of the Yerushalmi Talmud. He was the editor of the Yerushalmi. So Rabbi Yochanan says, and the reason that he gives is the key reason, and the formulation that he uses becomes the formulation throughout the halacha from his time on. And it is as this, Dvarim Shabitsina Nohek. Now, is that used in modern Hebrew? Sina? Dvarim Shabitsina, is that used? So Bitsina means private. Something that's used in private. Is it used, if you would say, in the privacy of his home, let's say?
It's not
a literary kind of thing?
It's a literary.
A literary kind of thing.
It's not uncommon to see that.
Uh-huh. So when it comes to the issue, you are using it.
There is a phrase, Sinat HaPrat.
Oh, that's good.
Sinat HaPrat is a public domain issue, Sinat HaPrat.
That's the privacy of the home, let's say, is called Sinat HaPrat?
Sinat HaPrat is the protection of the individual home.
Uh-huh.
It's just home, it's privacy.
It's a general notion of privacy, yeah. That there is a notion of privacy that surrounds an individual.
Yeah.
I see. Very interesting. So here, this is not so, just to go backwards then, Dvarim Shabitsina, the key one that we now know, in fact, you have to observe, it's not a matter of Rishut, is you have to continue to observe the prohibition against sexual relations, because that is the Davar Shabitsina.
Sure.
Okay? The other one, in all likelihood, is also Ne'ilat HaSandal. Ne'ilat HaSandal. Okay, that was what was included originally. What was it? Chatar. What was it?
Natar.
What? Ne'ilat HaSandal? Tashmish Amita? What?
The washing.
Oh, Rechitza. Rechitza B'chamin. Beleil Shabbat, right. So all of those now are Dvarim Shebitzina, right? And anything that is a Dvar Shebitzina is obligatory. You cannot.
So that means that Yesh Avelut B'Shabbat.
The final conclusion, therefore, is according to Rabbi Yochanan, Yesh Avelut B'Shabbat. Yesh Avelut B'Shabbat. And when we say there is mourning, that means Dvarim Shebitzina. The private matters of mourning are still obligatory on the Sabbath. The other side of that is the public matters.
Water, no sandals, no sex, no relations.
Correct.
At home.
At home.
Outside, you can wear.
You could wear shoes.
Definitely. How does that? It seems to make perfect sense to me, because my sense of this is that the reason for the public. The change in public mourning practice or the lack of mourning is in respect of the community's joy in Shabbat,
mm-hmm.
and not to interfere with the community's joy in Shabbat.
Mm-hmm. That's largely it. Although there's one other aspect to it too, and that is that the Shabbat also spills into the individual. I think it goes two ways. You're right, most of this is one way. It's the community and the individual. The individual has to cave before the obligations of the community. Well, maybe it would follow then. That would mean that it would spill into the individual's life too, because the individual is required to sit around the Sabbath table. The individual can have, doesn't have to have, but customarily will have meat and wine on the Sabbath. Although that's interesting, you know, meat and wine are not, we saw that they were prohibited during Aninut, but they're not prohibited during Shiva, interestingly enough. They're not prohibited during Shiva. Singing around the table, making Kiddush, those are obligatory upon the mourner.
So, I mean, so my feeling is they have to respect the community's right to have the joy of the Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you don't want them to forget they're in mourning, that they take on so much
exactly.
of the joy of Shabbat.
That's
that
correct. You can forget them.
They may feel guilty because they know that this is not quite right. So the rationale for doing it so that it doesn't interfere with the community is acceptable if the line is then drawn.
Correct. You have to have a line there.
So that they continue to feel like they're observing the mourning.
Right. And if it's private matters, that's a good place to draw a line.
Yeah, so the line seems very logical to me in terms of the way it plays out.
Yeah, I'm very glad that they came to this conclusion. This is the conclusion I wanted them to come to, and I'm almost amazed that it wasn't obvious to begin with.
Just as a matter of the process of it, if Rabbi Yochanan is in Israel and Rav is in Babylonia, they have differing views. How does this get resolved? That it's Rabbi Yochanan's view that gets accepted.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. There are two ways that this can get resolved. The first way is if it's the last point of view expressed in a discussion. When Maimonides wrote his Mishneh Torah, which is already then in the 12th century, 1179, he finished the Mishneh Torah. What he did in going through arguments like this is he assumed that the editors edited the text so that they would give you more or less discussion about a subject, and either sometimes they would say at the end of that discussion, Hilchata, this is the law. Once in a while you have that. In this case you do not have that. You do not have it. But you see that there is one point of view that comes at the end. Simply because it comes at the end, from Maimonides' point of view, was a very good indication that the editor and the editors reflecting the general tenor of the way in which this material was dealt with, the editor favored the last point of view. That's one issue, is just where it falls in the discussion. Second one is based on logic, that just one seems more compelling than the other. But frankly, the way this is edited, plus what I think is the compelling logic, are really the key issues here.
And it would have been then the Maimonides' determination.
Oh, let's go to the Tosafot. That's what the Tosafot ask. They are dealing with the same question here. Go to the Tosafot, Kaf Dalet Amud Aleph, and I'll show you the way this finally gets decided as the Tosafot discuss that. And realize the Tosafot are writing before Maimonides. So, in fact, the matter was decided before Maimonides. Okay, I just give you that example about how Maimonides works, because he's articulate about the way he goes about doing things. This person that the Tosafot are going to mention, we don't know the methodology. The Tosafot on the left side, remember the Tosafot now are, Rashi is on the inside, that's the pseudo-Rashi, that's the real Rashi, Tosafot is over here. Okay, it's on the outside of the page. And this Tosafot we're looking at is two-thirds of the way, three-quarters of the way down the page. And it begins, Hachi Amar Rabbi Yochanan Dvarim Shebetzina Nohek. Got that?
Yes.
Nope, do you have it?
I'm able to follow it.
I'm able to follow the Tosafot? Okay. Hachi Amar Rabbi Yochanan Dvarim Shebetzina Nohek. Right. That's the statement that we read. That's the quote that we read in the Gemara. Got it? Pasak b'halachot gedolot k'Rabbi Yochanan. Here he says the law was decided in the halachot gedolot. Halachot gedolot was among the very first compilations of halacha, which dates already from the 10th century. Maimonides, the 12th century. Okay, so this is a 10th century early compilation with Halachot Gedolot. Halachot Gedolot. The Halachot Gedolot, which is just at the end of the Gaonic period. The Gaonic period goes through the 10th century. Okay, The Lachot Gadolot, at the end of that period, ordered a number of the laws and made Piskei Halacha decisions, legal decisions. We rarely know what the reasoning is, because that's not the nature of this book. It was just a book of legal decisions. Okay? But here the Tosafot brings the fact that in the Halachot Gadolot, Pasak, that this is the law goes according to Rabbi Yochanan. Frequently what happens in the development of these things, it's not a straight line, but if the earliest Pasak Halacha is clear, there's a good chance that it's going to stay because of the power precedent in Jewish law. Precedent has a very strong place in the law. The law is not necessarily going to be decided according to precedent, but it's just a very strong argument in the later development of the law. And that, in fact, is what the Tosafot are doing. The Halachot Gedolot, I don't remember, I think it was Sephardi, but I'm not sure. The Tosafot are Ashkenazim, they're in France, and they are making it very clear by their statement that the Psak is according to the Halachot Gedolot, that it's also their Psak, because they could raise an objection with it if they felt it was a bad decision. You can do that in Jewish laws, you can in most legal systems, but they don't raise any objection. But notice what they are going to do. They're going to raise a logical problem. They accept the decision. They're going to raise an interesting problem. Pasak b'alachot gedolot k'Rabbi Yochanan la'puki mi'Rav u'Shmuel, in order to set aside the decisions of Rav and Shmuel, because Rav and Shmuel both accepted the notion of reshut. They differed on one little issue, but they both accepted the notion of optional, right? That these things were optional. It was optional whether he had sex or not. So this, the Halachot Gedolot clearly set aside the views of Rav and Shmuel. The Amri La'el Tashmish Amita Rishut. Those two who say above that sex is Rishut, right? It's optional whether you do or don't. Udvarim shebitzinahu, and this refers, of course, to matters which are private. Ubeferek kamek de ketubot goes on in the first chapter of Ketubot. Nami kamar ala mesaya leil Rabbi Yochanan di Abaye v'Rav Savrik Avate, and also it says in Masachet Ketubot in a similar matter that, and this shows us the strength of the position of Rabbi Yochanan, that there too Rava and Abaye abide by the positions articulated by Rabbi Yochanan. So here the Tosafot are now arguing for the strength of this as precedent.
For the primacy of Yochanan's opinion.
Right. That eventually among the Amoraim in Babylonia, even Rava and Abaye, and it's in Ketubot, which are in sexual matters, right? Rabbi Yochanan's position is the accepted position according to Rava and Abaye. So that's very strong now. So he said it's strong for because of the Halachot Gedolot, but that's only the 10th century. If you go back then to Rava and Abaye, who are major figures in the Talmud itself, they are accepting the position of Rabbi Yochanan in these areas.
Abaye is the one who questioned it in the first place.
Correct. Correct. That's true. Now, the Tosafot, they remember that there is another principle that, in fact, the Gemara has articulated elsewhere, which, as soon as they mention it, you're going to remember this principle. The Afal Gav the Kain Malan, even now, we know what the law is, but even now, if such the Kaimalan, we have another law, which is mentioned above, Daf Yudchet, and it's mentioned on Daf Kaftet, page 18 and page 22. Halacha Kedivrei Mekel, We learn the principle that the law in the laws of mourning goes according to the more lenient position. Now, that's interesting. Because the truth is, here where we have seen a variety of options, it ends up now that the law is going to the more stringent position. Ah, we forgot about that. That's right. The law should have gone toward the more lenient position, because that's what the Gemara in fact accepted in a variety of prior arguments. So Tosafot will bring that up now. And yet they are not disputing the point of view of Rabbi Yochanan. So they have to tell us how you can hold both points of view at the same time. And they do that. Hani mile b'machloket shel tanaim. That issue where you go according to the Nekil, to the more lenient position, that applies in an argument between Tanaim. But in an argument between Amoraim, that principle does not apply. Now that is an extraordinary important. It's a very important distinction. It becomes in Jewish law a major issue. Question is,
what do those two words mean?
The Tanaim are the teachers from the year 200 and before, earlier than this. Amoraim are 200 and after. The key document that sets them off is the Mishnah. The Mishnah is edited in 200. Okay? So Rabbi Yochanan is an Amora. He's an Amora. Rav and Shmuel are Amoraim. Okay? So the Tosafot say that in fact the idea of accepting a lenient position is only where we are dealing with an argument that goes way back in time. However, as things get closer to our time, the way to deal with them is not leniently but stringently. And that, in fact, becomes a major character of the development of the law. In fact, the things that go on in the time, the Talmud sometimes has incredible leniencies to it. But what later happens in the history of the law is that we accept the leniencies of the earlier period, but where similar issues can be debated at a later period, it tends to be, it's not a principle of law, but it tends to be that the more stringent position tends to be the position that's accepted.
What's the basis of the fear that people take advantage?
What's the basis? It's not articulated here. He doesn't articulate it at all. And it seems, from the way the Tosafot is constructed, it simply accepts. He's trying to explain why it is that the Gemara, in fact, had that position.
So he doesn't have his own statement.
No, they don't seek to explain it. They don't seek to explain it. And actually, in the history of law, there's a very interesting, and it's not as if there's only one way. It's not as if this is a principle that's always applied. It isn't. Because in the history of Jewish law, there are efforts always to say which authority in all truth has more strength. Which argument is more strength? In certain arguments, you could say the later authorities do. Because let's say they're more aware of the circumstances. Or today, for example, we get arguments, we know more history, we know more archaeology, and therefore certain things could and should be decided where the greater strength is to the later authority. Other things are clearly not decided that way, because the assumption is that the earlier authorities were more conversant with the language, the circumstances of the issue than we are, and therefore it goes with them. Okay? Clearly in this area, the assumption was that when the Tanaim debated something, there, interestingly enough, the Gemara seems to accept this principle of the lenient position takes precedence. And I think when you read that in the Gemara, my reaction to it always has been, it's a little bit surprising to imagine that in a religious system, a lenient position actually seems to take precedence and seems to be a principle. That's not what you usually expect in religious systems. You see that there's actually a limitation to it. It doesn't apply universally here. And in this case, it obviously doesn't apply.
Just to speculate, you might think that with the Tananim, that what happens is it's further from memory, and maybe people could say, well, look, maybe we're not as sure of what took place earlier, so we'll just go with
the leading position.
More, yeah.
It could be, and you could say that the later position is just closer to us, and therefore we tamper with it less. We don't have general principles that we apply to it. Instead, we just see the way that Mara edited it, and that must be the way it is.
I think that for some of this, though, the term minyan is not so obvious, at least not to me, especially when we talk about the sexual act. We were talking about the obligation of the mourner to his wife, right? So it may not be more lenient for that individual to have to fulfill that responsibility to his wife if he feels like he's in mourning.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think there's a lot more complexity to defining leniency for some of these things. I'm not challenging all of the other principles. I'm just saying
it's a good point.
It's not so easy to define.
And keep in mind that we ourselves have said, and we've always been troubled by this, the leniency problem. The leniency, for example, of the Yom Tov cutting off Shiva. That's taken by the Talmud to be lenient. We have exactly the opposite reaction. You're not allowing people to observe mourning, and they really need it. You could take that and go to what you're saying. Really, these restrictions are good for you, and they're not bad for you. It's not good to have the whole idea of leniency just doesn't work in these circumstances. You really need these rules. And if you take the rules away, yeah, you might say that's lenient, but it's really not lenient as far as a mourner goes. I think that's kosher.
Does the Yerushalmi ever come into play with respect to deciding what halakha is?
Sometimes, but not a great deal. That was, frankly, one of the things that people like Lieberman were doing, and these things are being done today, largely because the Yerushalmi wasn't used the way the Bavli was. Remember, the Babylonian Talmud had a continuity of time, place, and geography. North Africa and the Middle East, the Caliphate was in Baghdad, this stuff is coming out of the same area. So there was a continuity of leadership and a continuity of courts. And that disappeared in the land of Israel. The Yerushalmi became a textbook that people studied but didn't use. And therefore, it never had the force until recent times. Maimonides used it some, so get it in Maimonides, because he believed that certain things should be decided on the basis of the Yerushalmi, because of the Yerushalmi might have some deeper insight. But most people didn't accept that. It's only in the modern period that we rediscovered the Yerushalmi again.
If I understand this correctly, while the later opinions may be less lenient, so to speak, the concept of options is developed to a greater degree.
In a later period?
Yes.
Goodness.
So that counterbalances
mm-hmm.
the leniency usage.
Mm-hmm. Goodness. Yes.
So we have the books that
helped develop? Yeah.
We do have.
Yes, yeah. Rarely published today, but you can go to seminary and get it.
So, are the laws
interesting
to read?
I've never read. Closest I've ever come is to read the earliest of the Ashkenazi compilations of Halakha, which was, and you'll understand when I tell you the name of the book, why I was reading it. It was called the Or Zarua. So I actually have had reason, and we have a copy of the Or Zarua here in the building, which was given to us as a gift, just because it's this. That is the author who wrote an early compilation of Halakha, but I've never read the Halakha Kedamot. The only way you see it are in these Tosafot, or if you look also on the Ein Mishpat Ner Mitzvah, Let me just see whether you can see the position. Sometimes you'll see. I don't see any here. No, I don't see any. Sometimes you'll see in the end mishpat ne'amitzvah reference made to the halachah kedamot. It was obviously used.
And each reference, one thing I want to present, the reference here, la'el dot yudchet and whatever.
Well, it was yudchet with a one dot. Where you see one dot, that means amud aleph.
Is that an interpolation, or did the Tosfot have?
It's probably an interpolation. Because you're right, during the time of the Tosafot, there was no pagination of the Talmud the way we have it today. So that must be post-pagination. All of that comes after the printing press.
But did they actually have a written Talmud?
Oh, yeah, they definitely had a written Talmud. Definitely. Henry, sure. Manuscript. Yep. Oh, yeah, they had a written Talmud, and there were manuscripts of the Talmud. That's how the Talmud was studied, through the written manuscripts. There were obviously weren't many of them, but that's how it was studied in the schools.
When do we think the first written? That's not the way they studied.
Well, the Talmud is written at an early stage of the game.
After 500?
Yeah.
After 500.
Yeah. Probably were written forms of it before 500, but certainly when we say that the Talmud was edited, the assumption there is that it was edited in a written, not an oral form. The earlier editing of the Mishnah, that's not so clear. Lieberman argued that the Mishnah was edited orally and not in a written form, even though there were written copies around. But when we say editing, Lieberman argued it meant editing of the oral form and not of the written form. But at a point not very much after that, and it's all written down.
Are there any extant manuscripts?
The oldest manuscripts we have is the Munich manuscript. There are manuscripts of the Talmud, yes. There are manuscripts in European libraries, some in Israel. We have in the seminary library. There are Talmudic manuscripts which are in the Vatican Library. The Vatican is one of the richest sources of Talmudic manuscripts because the church would confiscate them. Remember, the church went through periods when they would collect Talmuds and burn them. They were burning of Talmuds. So, you know, they couldn't burn them all, and they didn't want to burn them all. They were very good bibliophiles, the priests. And so they sent a lot of it to the Vatican, and where it is till this day. it's still one of the greatest treasure troves of Jewish literature is in Vatican City. It's a little bit bizarre, but there's a lot of history there.
Okay, so the oldest Talmud manuscript.
I believe it goes back to about the 13th century.
Not before?
No. And we have pieces of a manuscript in the Cairo Geniza, for example. We have things in the Cairo Geniza, which we have up in the seminary. So we have little pieces, but they're not manuscripts. They're not full manuscripts. Mm-hmm. We have a full manuscript, which was the Munich manuscript. What did I say before?
Munich.
That manuscript, we do have a full copy of.
What year is that?
I think it's the 13th century.
Vatican?
No, the Munich manuscript, I believe, is still in Munich. Mm-hmm. I think it's still there. There are photocopies. Of course, today things are on disk, so they're much more accessible. But the actual things themselves are in very few libraries. Oxford has some. Bodleian Library.
I think we ordered that book, Writing the Talmud.
Do you
have it in
the Talmud? Oh, yes. From the Yeshiva University's exhibit, right.
That's
right.
It's either here or we'll be here very soon.
That's great. Terrific.
And what is the time course of the prohibition?
Thank you.
Is it the whole year?
Yeah. No.
Or
7 days.
Just 7 days.
7 days. Very good. We'll see you next week.
I'll be missing three
classes.
Good. I'll see you. I'll miss you next day.